and welcome back to the Research Talks podcast here from Stockbox with just me and Dan Flynn today, because Alan is indeed on holiday motorbiking around Spain, I think, isn't it, Dan?
That's
I think
right.
He's down in Spain. Yeah. So Alan will be back next week, so it's just going to be a little bit of a shorter research talk this week, and not really a whole lot to note on the markets from my point of view. I mean, we are approaching the end of May. Typically, things start to get warmer, which they obviously are doing now, certainly in the UK and Europe, and people start to go away. But nothing has really caught my eye. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about Delta Gold. That's having a bit of a pullback, which is always healthy, as long as it's keep retracing. You don't want everything to go up in a straight line. And the other one, which is, of course, you're going to talk about, Dan, is Buccaneer Energy, who we have covered before. But they were having a good week, started on Monday, moving up, and Tuesday had a really good day as well, and they've sort of leveled off now at around 11 or 0.011, 0.012, that kind of level. But I won't sort of, you know, rain on your parade by talking about them too much now. But yeah, anything else? Has anything sort of caught your eye, Dan, this week particularly?
Yeah, I mean, it's an odd week in the markets because the big indexes are continuing to run higher. And I was talking to someone about this earlier. I mean, if you'd been in hibernation, didn't know about the war, you'd be thinking we were having like the best macro backdrop in the world. And reality is a lot of it's driven by AI. And while I don't think it's like the dot-com boom, because there's some real, I mean, all the companies are investing real proper money into this. It's not just startups, but you know, expectations at some point probably won't be met. And then with bond yields and inflation running up, I do feel like there'll be a correction, not to be too much of a downer, but it's realistic. It'd be nice to see some progress in the Iran conflict, get that out of the way so the rest of the market will be on a stronger footing. But as for the smaller cap space itself, Buccaneer, like you say, looking good. Delta, it's dropped by quite a lot, but it had run up a hell of a lot. And it's quite illiquid, so I think all it takes is a couple of people deciding to cash in to move it down. Still very bullish on that one over the longer term, continuing to hold it. FDR, looking good value, I think. We speak to Tristan a lot. And the update that came out today, and I spoke to CEO Rory earlier today for an interview that's coming out next week, is Arcle, which has announced that it's identified a load of uranium targets and it's advanced drilling, which is really good to see. I think the company pivoted to uranium not so long ago, and it's been getting to work behind the scenes. And yeah, it came out today and said, you know, not only have we found all these targets, but they're looking so good that we want to get drilling quicker than we thought. So the bit will begin turning next month on one target, and then later on, I think Q3 for another target, and that's just two licenses of, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's like six or eight or something. So there's loads to get working on, really, and it still has a market cap of less than 10 million. So a bit like Botswana Minerals, which is another company I'm going to cover today. It's not certain, you know, this is very early stage, but you get, it's nice to have a few of these in the portfolio, isn't it? Because if you get in on them at this early stage and even one of the targets advances, then you're laughing.
Absolutely. And it has been moving up quite nicely as well, Ark. It's had a good sort of last, certainly 6 months anyway. So,
it has,
good.
Still very small though. Yeah.
Mm. Okay, well, Buccaneer Energy then, Dan, talk to us about Buccaneer. What's your research been telling you? Because this is still a very small market cap company. Of course, it moved up, as I said, early part of this week, but it's still only a 2 million market cap company, and they make more than that a year in profit, right? From the production of the wells. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I wanted to take a look at the company today. We were talking about it. Both holders and like what it's doing. And like you say, it has bounced up over the last week, but I think there's still a very good argument for it looking undervalued. When I was doing my research, its market cap was around 2.6 million. And for that, you're getting a company that's already producing oil, it's already generating cash, and has a pretty clear route to increasing production over the coming months. So, quick bit of context, Buccaneer used to be Nostra Terra. It's an oil and gas exploration production company with a portfolio of production and development assets in Texas. Current production is around 150 barrels of oil per day, and that's split across a few assets. Roughly 50 barrels a day comes from the Falk area at Pine Mills, which includes Falk 1, Falk 2, and the recently acquired Carlisle well. The rest comes from the wider Pine Mills field and other assets in West and South Texas. So I think an important thing to note first is cost, because in the Falk area, operating costs are extremely low because there's effectively no produced water in that part of the field. It's just oil, and the main cost is therefore just electricity. So you're talking about costs of around $5 a barrel. And elsewhere where there is water that needs to be handled and disposed of, costs are more like $20 to $25 a barrel. But even that's really low. And with oil prices currently well above those levels, Bacchanier is generating a very strong margin. So based on recent company figures from interviews and announcements talking to the company, it looks to be generating somewhere around $200,000 to $270,000 a month in operating margin at current production levels. So if we're conservative and call it around $200,000 a month after allowing for royalties and moving parts, that's roughly £150,000 a month. So yeah, these are back of the fag packet numbers, but the point is simple. I mean, this is a 2.6 million company already generating a meaningful chunk of that market cap in recurring monthly cash flow. And that's not something you can say about most small cap resource stocks. So while it's not the sexiest story in the world, numbers are interesting. And they become even more interesting when you look at what's coming next. So a couple of things here. First, there's the organic oil recovery work. So earlier this year, Bacchanier completed a pilot for this program at Pine Mills. Mark, I know you spoke to Paul Welch, the CEO, about it at the time, but simply put, the company injected a nutrient-based treatment into part of the reservoir designed to stimulate naturally occurring microbes. And these can help mobilize residual oil and improve flow through the reservoir and often reduce the amount of water produced with the oil. So, you know, it's not magic. It's not some brand new untested idea. It's a known enhancing oil recovery techniques. But the results from Bacchanier's pilot were very strong. Production in the treated area increased by around 100%. And in one treated well, the water cut reportedly fell from 80% to zero. So it means more oil, less water, lower power and handling costs, and all at the cost of what is basically a routine field workover. So Bacchanier's now preparing to expand that across the wider fields. And if it works anything like the pilot did, I think the figure is around 40 to 50 barrels a day of extra production in relatively short order. And, you know, considering production is only 150 barrels a day at the moment, that's pretty meaningful for a company this size. So the bigger driver beyond that is the planned water flood in the Falk area. So water flooding is a very standard technique in mature oil fields. Basic idea is that you inject water into the reservoir, usually down dip or into a suitable injection point, to maintain pressure and push more oil towards the producing wells. So instead of just relying on the natural pressure of the reservoir, you're actively improving recovery. And in a field like Pine Mills, where water flooding has already worked historically, that matters. So Bacchanier is now working to establish a water flood unit in the Falk area. The company wants to use the Turner and Daniel wells on the ground it staked last November as potential injection points. And if it can get the water flood moving, the numbers could be really material here. So Bacchanier suggested the operation could recover an additional 667,000 to just over 1 million barrels of oil from the area. And that would multiply the remaining Falk reserves, increase production, and potentially give Bacchanier a much larger share of the economics, because its interest in the proposed water flood unit could rise from 32.5% to more than 50%. And importantly, with a water flood unit, production isn't capped in the same way as with current individual well limits, which are around 120 barrels a day, I think.
They're unlimited. 24. Yeah. It's interesting that. Yeah, that lifts that limit, which is good.
Yeah, so it gets a greater share of the economics from potentially much larger per well production. So if the field responds well, there's more room for production to grow. And on top of that, once that water flood's done, the company's also planning two additional wells, which would be Falk 4 and the sidetrack of Alar 1, which was the disappointing well that didn't deliver earlier this year. But the company has de-risked somewhat for having another go at doing a sidetrack up it. So you put it all together, the organic oil recovery, water flood, new wells, and Buccaneers targeting an exit rate of around 250 barrels of oil per day by the end of the year. So there's execution risk, obviously. It actually has to deliver, the field has to respond. Oil prices could obviously move against the company. But if it does get to 250 barrels, the maths gets interesting. You know, 150 barrels, we were talking about roughly $200,000 a month in conservative operating margin. At 250 barrels on the same rough assumptions, that could move towards $330,000 a month. So 250,000 pounds, again, rough numbers, but a 2.6 million market cap, that would put the company on less than a year's worth of annualized operating cash flow. And that's before we give any credit for the reserve upside. I mean, the last borrowing base reserve update in January put total proved net reserves at around $9.6 million. And that was at a conservative $60 oil price and before we even considered the water flood. So yeah, that's the investment case for me. The company was punished hard after that failure at Alar 1. Share price has recovered a bit, but it still looks very conservative against what the business is producing, what it could be producing if the next phase goes to plan.
Yeah, I think it's very undervalued. It's not often you can find the company sort of at that sort of £1 million mark. And obviously now Buccaneers moved up a bit to sort of that 2 million area. But still, I mean, you know, fair value, I think, is even today, just based on the what's happening right now, I think you've got to talk double where we are, like four million, really. You know, your sort of share price of just sort of 25, you know, 0.25 to 0.30 effectively, but then doesn't factor in any of the upside from the full organic oil recovery rollout. And on that, there was a special feature that we did with Paul and the chap from Hunting, which was really interesting. It's actually a nice watch, that. And I think it was actually suggested that they did the OOR by one of their big shareholders, Gervais Williams of Premier Miton. And I will be speaking to Gervais next week, specifically on Buccaneer and what him and the company and the, you know, the fund think of that. But yeah, I mean, when you put it all together, I mean, Paul has set out the target in a recent interview there for 200 to 250 by year end. So your maths works out there, Dan. You know, you're looking sort of 3-ish million to, well, sort of circa 4 million per year in profit. Now that is before the royalty, so you can sort of take 20% off of that. And that was, because when we had our chat to him, that was quite interesting, I thought, that all the royalty owners that has gone down generation after generation after generation. And he said it went out, the royalties went out to the eighth decimal place, I think.
Yeah, it was something bad like that.
Yeah. Not a problem for paying out, but it's sort of, it complicates things when sort of trying to make moves like forming the unit, for example. That's why it can take time, because you've got to, is it 65% of the royalty owners, I think you had to agree. I think it was around that
that's
number.
Right, so you have to track people down that may have been holding on.
Yeah,
to
track people down to,
like,
who were like generational removed from the original, because it was the Turner well, for example, was by a guy called Turner, you know, and it's his sort of family's legacy that's carried on. But anyway, the point is, yeah, I mean, Paul is, what I've liked to see, I'm a big fan of Buccaneer ever since Paul took over. I think it was nearly 2 years ago now, actually. I think it was around August 2 years ago. I would have liked to have seen it progress a bit quicker. I would have, of course, liked to have seen, you know, oil flowing from Alar 1, but it is what it is. But, you know, he set out a key target now that we can hold him accountable for the end of the year there. There's major milestones, which is, of course, the full organic oil recovery rollout plus the water flood, and then they'll be drilling the is it two wells, wasn't it? I would plan to sidetrack Alar 1 and go for Falk 4 once they've water flooded, so they've pressurized the reservoir effectively. So that might not happen until early next year, but we've definitely got things to keep him accountable to, which is good, right? And maybe the market's starting to realize that it's undervalued. You know, you've got a company there that very few on the markets actually in this space make money. Very few. Lose money.
Yeah. And it's not like, even if we get a resolution to the Iran situation, it's not, I mean, the expectation is that oil prices are going to be elevated for a long time from here.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly.
Don't worry about that too much right now.
Yeah, exactly. That's the general thesis, I think. Yeah. Excellent. Okay, good stuff, Dan. Thank you for that. So then you want to talk about Botswana Minerals, formerly Botswana Diamonds.
That's right, yeah. Starting to get interesting there. Now, this is still very early stage. I want to be clear on that. Up front, there's not a resource. Drilling hasn't started yet. And as with any early stage explorer, a lot can still, you know, not come to what you'd hope. But since we last covered the company, the story has moved forward very quickly. And that's the important point here, because last time Botswana Minerals was really at the data review stage. It had this big historic database, a large land package in northern Botswana. And it was using AI-assisted exploration work to start turning that data into targets. So at that point, the investment case was basically, can this tiny company use these modern exploration tools to find something meaningful in an underexplored area? And since then, we've had two updates, and both show real progress. The first came in April, so last month, and that update identified a 9.5-kilometer copper anomaly, a 20-kilometer silver anomaly corridor, and a 2.4-kilometer lead zinc zone. So already the company was beginning to move from a broad regional idea towards more specific mineralized trends. And that mattered because it suggested the system wasn't just throwing up random dots on a map, there were actually patterns starting to emerge. But the latest update, which came this week, is the bigger one for me. Beamin has now identified 36 copper anomalies grouped into six exploration corridors across just two of its eight licenses. And that last bit is important, because this isn't the whole land package, it's just a small part of it. And already the AI-assisted work has produced, you know, nearly 40 targets. So the company is using Planetary AI's Explore platform to pull together geology, structures, geophysics, geochemistry, remote sensing, all that sort of stuff. And in plain English, it's basically just taking a lot of messy exploration data and helping the company work out where the best copper targets might be. So we shouldn't get carried away, because these are anomalies. They're not discoveries, but they are the right kind of early stage signs. I mean, the targets sit in a geological corridor linking Namibia's Damara Belt with the Central African Copper Belt. So it's a good regional address. And the company has also pointed to favorable carbon at host rocks, major fault structures, possible fluid pathways, and several target areas with features consistent with known copper and polymetallic systems in the region. So it does, none of that proves there's a deposit, but it does give Botswana Minerals something to work with. And that's the whole game, isn't it, when you're at this stage? Mm. So the next steps are clear. Fieldwork is expected to begin within 3 months. The company will rank those 36 targets. It will plan field programs across the highest priority corridors, and it will extend the AI-assisted work across the other six licenses. And the aim seems pretty simple to me. They want to take this big list of targets and narrow it down and get the best ones out there. And then they can start to build on it with drilling. And, you know, it's still speculative from an investment point of view. You don't bet the house necessarily on something like this. But I think there's a few reasons it's worth having exposure right now. First, the market cap is tiny. It's only around £4.5 million. So if one of these targets starts to look genuinely interesting through fieldwork and then drilling, the share price could move pretty quickly. Second, Botswana is a strong mining jurisdiction. It's stable. It's got a mining history. And this part of the country remains underexplored for copper. I think it's underexplored for everything other than diamonds, really, Botswana. Third, it's good to see that the company is actually doing what it said it would do. It raised just over $1 million at the end of March. Been carrying out relatively low-cost desktop AI supported work, and now it's moving towards field exploration. That's good to see. It's also the fact that copper remains a strong market. Prices are up. We need more of it. Big deposits are hard to find, take ages to bring into production. So anything new in a good jurisdiction is going to attract attention quickly. And then there's also the extra optionality. First of all, like I said, these results are only from two licenses. There's six more to review still. But in the background, Botswana Minerals still has its diamond assets. Like you said, it wasn't long ago that the company was called Botswana Diamonds. And while these aren't the focus right now, they haven't disappeared either. So that's something that the company will return to when the market is looking a bit more buoyant. So yeah, classic early stage exploration story of an AI angle. It could easily disappoint. That's the risk. But if the fieldwork confirms these targets are meaningful, even if one corridor starts to build towards a drill story, then this could become a very different company very quickly. And that's why I hold a position, not because it's a sure thing, but at this valuation, the risk reward looks very attractive to me.
Good. Thank you. I know we've been following Botswana Minerals, formerly Botswana Diamonds, for a while. And it's good that they have pivoted to other commodities in Botswana, because diamonds was always, very eggs in one basket, I would say. And it's also the diamond market. It's very much driven by retail, basically, or consumers, let's say, consumer driven. And also with the invent of lab-grown diamonds, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Dan, would your wife be unhappy if she got a lab-grown diamond as a ring?
I actually had this conversation with her, and she basically said, yeah, it wouldn't be the same if it was lab-grown diamond. But okay. I don't know if that's how everyone feels.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, you want to get the... But when a commodity like that is very much driven by consumerism... And mostly weddings, because it's not even really considered a store of wealth, even though it's a very good store of wealth. It isn't really, you know, people go to gold rather than diamonds for wealth storage. So, yeah, it's always tricky, right? And just, I don't think anyone's really sure what's going to happen to that diamond market. I mean, for industry, lab grown has replaced it, I think, almost completely. I think it does just come down to how much disposable income people have, which is quite a risky approach, I'd say. So yeah, it's good to see they've done that, and of course it is early stage, like you say. So it's obviously a bit risky, but you've got to start somewhere, right? And we will keep an eye on them and see how they go.
Yeah, I think you're right on that eggs in one basket comment, because while I focus mainly on copper here, it isn't just copper that these are prospective for. It's a basket of metals. So it is spreading that risk somewhat, beyond diamonds and beyond just metals. So yeah, good thing to do in this sort of market.
Exactly. Right. Excellent. Well, thank you, Dan. So we will speak next week with Alan as well. But enjoy the bank holiday weekend.
You too. Have a good one.
If you enjoyed this interview, then give us a thumbs up, a like, or a retweet. Subscribe to us on YouTube or follow us on Twitter, and hit that notification bell to be the first to know when we release new content. There's loads of great content on our website too, across all our programs at stockboxmedia.com. Thank you for watching.